A few years ago, I was reporting a story about sea lamprey. I went to the Hammond Bay Biological Station on Lake Huron, where they do a lot of research on these invasive fish. And I had the opportunity to meet one face to face. If you've never seen one, they look prehistoric. They're a long tubular fish that sort of look like an eel, except they have an open circular mouth full of little sharp teeth. They attach to the side of the fish and use their sharp tongues to rasp a hole through the scales and suck out the blood. The researcher asked me if I wanted to put one on my palm, and although I didn't admit that was really the main reason I wanted to go to the station, I didn't pass it up.
Whoa.
See that?
They make a strong suction with their mouths, and when you pull them off your hand, you can hear an audible pop. Sea lamprey have been a huge problem in the Great Lakes for a long time, and we'll hear about a new documentary chronicling their rise and fall this week on the Up North Lowdown from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Max Copeland. We'll hear about that, and we'll meet a Petoskey architect with a big goal to build 100 houses. But first, Michigan has some ambitious climate goals, including moving to clean energy sources by 2040. At the same time, though, Michigan is growing its natural gas infrastructure, even as it aims to zero out greenhouse gas emissions in the coming decades. IPR climate reporter Izzy Ross takes us to Meesick in Wexford County, where a new natural gas project is just getting started.
It's a wet and windy Friday, not ideal for a groundbreaking ceremony. But Buckley Mayor Takis Pfeiffer is all smiles.
How big of a deal is natural gas? It's huge.
DTE is planning to lay down 20 miles of pipeline to get natural gas to residents and businesses around Meesick and Buckley. Pfeiffer worked as an analyst for DTE for a couple years. He says most people in the area heat their homes with propane or wood stoves. And giving them another choice, he says, just makes sense.
Basically, it came to us saying, hey, if you want this as an option, it's available.
One of the big draws is cost. DTE says the project will cut heating bills. That, plus a short payback period for customers, made the decision to pursue the project easy, Pfeiffer says.
Propane was good, but natural gas is so much cheaper that that's why it becomes really the front runner.
Natural gas is the state's biggest source of electricity, and it's the primary heat source for more than three-quarters of Michigan households. So as the state tries to transition away from fossil fuels, where do projects like this fit in?
Well, we call it methane gas or fossil gas because it is a fossil fuel.
James Geniak manages policy in the Midwest for the Union of Concerned Scientists. That group promotes science-based policy solutions and has long been a voice for fighting climate change. Natural gas is mostly methane, and methane is extremely potent. It's much more efficient at trapping heat in the atmosphere than carbon dioxide. Geniak says burning natural gas generally produces slightly fewer emissions than propane and is better than wood. But he says we should consider the total footprint.
There's also leakage from the gas production and transportation system from where it's extracted and then moved through pipelines. So methane gas is a significant contributor to climate change pollution.
Michigan's My Healthy Climate Plan calls for reducing reliance on natural gas. Still, this project in Meesick got millions through a state grant for what it called low-carbon energy infrastructure. Geniak says moving away from coal is vital, but how that happens matters. He says to reduce carbon emissions, the focus should be on electric heating, not natural gas.
It's really important to carefully scrutinize any proposed investments in building new gas plants when we have these alternative technologies that we need to really be focused on ramping up as quickly as possible.
DTE is making big changes. It's planning to shut down its last coal-powered plant by 2032. Ultimately, the utility is aiming for net zero carbon emissions by 2050, and it's maintained that natural gas is an important part of its transition away from coal. Many proponents call it a bridge fuel between old fuel sources and renewable energy, like solar.
What they're calling a bridge fuel, really it's a bridge to nowhere because we are in the midst of a climate crisis.
Ashley Rudzinski is the Climate and Environment Program Director with Groundwork Center, a nonprofit in northern Michigan. She says they're disappointed that DTE is continuing to invest in natural gas.
It's really important to invest locally and invest in systems that are going to improve our energy security and the reliability of our grid. And for us, that means renewable energy.
I'm going to do one more.
All right, you got to make that work.
Back at the groundbreaking ceremony, politicians, realtors, a school superintendent, contractors, all gather under the tent. In the background are huge coils of yellow tubing and excavators. Scotty Kehoe is a regional gas operations director for DTE.
Natural gas is one of those ways that we're reducing our carbon footprint. While natural gas might not be a renewable energy source, it is a very clean energy source.
He says, yes, it is a bridge between technologies, and he doesn't see it going anywhere anytime soon.
I believe that natural gas will always have a place and a responsibility in the foreseeable future in helping us provide that safe, reliable heat source and energy production while helping us to get to whatever that future technology is that really gets us to our ultimate goals.
But for those who want to move away from fossil fuels entirely, that's a worrying thought.
IPR climate reporter Izzy Ross. Her work comes to us through a partnership with Grist. The documentary film Relentless takes us through three eras of the Great Lakes, before invasive sea lamprey showed up, when they were at their peak, and how scientists finally figured out how to control them. It was recently shown in Traverse City as part of a series of events on freshwater from the Traverse City International Affairs Forum. IPR environment reporter Ellie Katz hosted a Q&A right after the screening, and before the event, she spoke with Morning Edition host Tyler Thompson about the documentary.
So, for people who have never seen a sea lamprey, they're wicked. Can you describe them for listeners?
Yes. Yeah, so they have this nickname called vampire fish, and that's because they kind of look like eels, even though they're not. They're these jawless fish. And when they open their mouths, they've got circular rows of really gnarly looking teeth in there. And they kind of latch onto the side of big fish like lake trout and kind of suck the life out of them. And this film has a lot of cool footage of lamprey throughout their life cycle. So as eggs in the larval phase, when they kind of chill out in the riverbed of rivers, and then as adults swimming in the Great Lakes. And actually, I learned from this movie that we do have a few native species of lamprey in the Great Lakes, but the sea lamprey is much larger and was invasive for that reason.
Can you talk a little bit about what this is?
Yeah, it takes you through the kind of crazy story of the sea lamprey invasion and how scientists figured out how to control that. You know, it gives us this historical context of these massive commercial fishing operations that were set up in the Great Lakes in the early 20th century. Lots of cool old photos and videos of fishing boats and fishing crews. Takes us from that time period all the way up through the invasion, which really kind of kicked off in the 30s and 40s. And takes us through these people who kind of watch their businesses and livelihoods crumble, then onto the scientists who were really determined to figure out everything they could about sea lamprey in order to control them, which was something Congress at the time really doubted they'd be able to do. And here's a clip from the movie that really just, it paints a good picture of how devastating the arrival of these animals were.
The fish were dead on the bottom of the lake, especially in the fall when they were spawning. If you swept your nets a bit on the bottom when you're pulling them up, the tugs would stink so bad you couldn't stand to be on the boat from all the big fish laying on the bottom.
So dead fish on the bottom of the lakes, dead fish getting reeled up in boats, it was really just a massacre of native fish species. And this movie kind of charts that entire story.
So you watched the film. What did you take away from it, and why should people care?
Yeah, you know, the story of sea lamprey is a story that I've heard several times. It's, you know, you hear about the invasion, these scary fish, and then this kind of crazy science to get to control them. But I learned so much more about that story from this movie, and so much more about this region and these lakes that I love and that I call home. And I think you know, that's why people should care. It's when you know about the history of the place that you live and how that history kind of pulls through its threads into the lives that we live today, that's just important and worthwhile. And people should care because the ways sea lamprey changed the Great Lakes were astonishing and continue to affect the lakes today. Plus, like I said, there's a lot of really cool old photos and videos of fish and fishermen in the Great Lakes in the early 1900s. And those are just fun.
That's IPR's Tyler Thompson with environment reporter Ellie Katz. There was some good news recently for commercial fishing on Lake Michigan, by the way. Joel Peterson captained the fish tug Joy back to the dock with a whopping 1,700 pounds of whitefish last week. He says it's the biggest haul of whitefish he has had in years.
The last 3 or 4 years, a big day was 1,000 pounds, but before that, we were getting 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 pounds, but our quota was 65,000.
He says his quota for this year is about 17,000 pounds. These fish were filleted by Carlson's Fisheries. When we come back, we'll meet architect Michael Carr in Petoskey, who hopes his legacy will be houses. A lot of houses.
You know, at the end of the day, I want to be able to look back at those 100 houses and say, hey, I did the best I could. Here's what I left behind.
Stick around. The Lowdown returns in a moment.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Mental health.
Mental health.
Mental health.
Mental health.
Mental health is on our mind.
We are a group of high school students in Northern Michigan, and we're part of the Youth Wellness Initiative, a project that aims to better understand the mental health needs of teens in our region.
We surveyed over 500 of our fellow high school students to ask them about their mental health.
Now we are taking our key findings and talking to our teachers, our school counselors, our principals, and professionals in the community about some of the big questions that came up in the process.
Find our new podcast, Reframe of Mind.
Reframe of Mind.
Reframe of Mind.
At interlochenpublicradio.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Up North Lowdown. I'm Max Copeland. Back in December, we brought you a series called A Crisis of Care about how parents, providers, and employers in Northern Michigan really struggle with affordable childcare. One of the families we spoke with, the Amidons of Manistee, are heading to the nation's capital to make their case to lawmakers for better policy. IPR's Tyler Thompson tells us a little more.
The Amidons were invited by Zero to Three, an early childhood advocacy group based in Washington, D.C. Each year, a family is chosen from every state for the annual visit to the Capitol. The Amidons will represent Michigan families and will meet one-on-one with U.S. Senators Gary Peters, Debbie Stabenow, and Congressman John Molinar. Rebecca Amidon says they will advocate for more affordable, high-quality child care, national paid family and medical leave, plus more.
While we are meeting with, say, Senator Gary Peters, I will have my one-year-old and our four-year-old. He'll be running around the room being crazy. The point of this is for lawmakers to see and understand how difficult it is for parents to work while having their children at home with them.
The Amidons head to D.C. April 30th.
That's IPR's Tyler Thompson. You can find more about the Amidon story in our series, A Crisis of Care, available at iprnews.org. Now we're going to dip back into another recurring series called Fresh Coast Creatives.
This is Fresh Coast Creatives from IPR, a series about artists and inspiration in Northern Michigan. Each episode, we go into the studios and creative spaces of local artists and talk about what makes them tick. I'm Max Howard. A lot of artists want to leave behind some kind of legacy, a work with their unique fingerprint on it. But Michael Carr has a plan for what he'll leave behind, 100 homes. He figures it will take him 25 years.
And for me, there was something like incredibly exciting to be able to like, hey, could I spend my life basically doing something that if I do it well, it'll outlive myself.
Michael's the architect and owner of the design studio, North 45 Architecture. We met at his office, which he designed and had built to replace the old carriage house behind his home in Petoskey. The studio is modern but warm, a small but tall building. Through the huge glass door, you can see the meeting space where Michael greets clients. Behind that is a ladder up into his actual workspace.
You know what, could I see
absolutely.
Up here?
Of course.
Do you want to go first or you want me to?
I'll go first, just grab up here, that's easier.
The wood that lines the front of the building, that makes up the ladder, and the table we have our interview at, were all reclaimed from the carriage house this studio replaced.
You know, I've got this tagline for my company, like, simple, honest, unapologetically modern architecture. And so, like, the unapologetically modern is kind of about, hey, I'm not trying to pretend that this was built 100 years ago.
Yeah, this we're going to have today. An 8-foot glass door.
I'm going to respect the history, but all the detailing is going to be modern.
Michael compares what he does to being a singer.
You should know who you are and what you do. There's not many singers that say, well, today I'll sing country, but tomorrow I'm going to sing opera, and then maybe the next day I'll sing rock.
Michael found his way into architecture through a drafting class he took almost by chance in Mount Pleasant.
So, you know, I always looked up to my older brother. He was a few years ahead of me, and he took a high school drafting class. And so just basically kind of out of curiosity, older brother did it. As a sophomore in high school, you know, I gave it a shot.
Soon, he was sold.
When it's all said and done, what do you spend your life doing? Mm-hmm. And there's not many things, like, in this world that are more permanent than a well-loved house.
Michael later went to graduate school at the University of Michigan. And after that, he worked for the Payette architectural firm out in Boston. Payette designs these hospitals and university buildings. And Michael showed me some pictures of projects from his time at the firm. One was a marketing photo for a science lab they had just built.
Is that you?
Yeah, you know, photo shoot day.
I had to pretend
I was a scientist, right?
Wait, can we go back to that?
Yeah, sure.
They have you dressed up as a scientist here?
Yeah,
do you remember? Did they give you a beaker or anything?
Well, they gave me a piece of paper.
Back in Michigan, Michael launched his company, North 45. That was in 2017. He had this idea you can see on his website, the 100 Homes Project. He signs each on a number as he counts down.
You know, I only do about 4 projects a year. Mm-hmm. And so 25 years left to work, 4 projects a year, that's 100 houses. And so that will be my life's work. You know, at the end of the day, I want to be able to look back at those 100 houses and say, hey, I did the best I could. Here's what I left behind.
With each new house, Michael gets to put more of his own unique designs into the home.
Right. So the first commission I may have done, you know, up in the upper 90s, might have been quite traditional. Mm-hmm. You know, okay, and then mid-90s, starting to get, you know, a few more modern touches to them, right? Yeah. So it's kind of like a gradual progression to where I want to get to be.
It'll be interesting to see that gradient as it progresses. Like, where are you going to be in your 50s and then the 40s?
Yeah, I'm pretty ecstatic about where I am now.
Michael says he's fortunate to work in such a beautiful part of the country. He pulls out the architectural drawing for House 87. It's modern, with its mix of sawn cedar and distressed metal siding, and is built under the slope of a hill overlooking a wooden ravine. Beyond that, you can see Lake Michigan.
You know, if I've got a site that's got, you know, 300 feet of Lake Michigan frontage with rolling sand dunes, my job is to basically just take advantage of that. You know, the architecture should just try not to mess that up.
Yeah.
here's the view. Here's what the site is giving you. Mm-hmm. And everything that I try to do tries to take advantage of that. And often the architecture tries to be almost deferential to it.
Michael is currently on House 83. He should finish his last home around 2042. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Max Howard.
Support for Fresh Coast Creatives comes from the Northwest Michigan Arts and Culture Network through an award from the Michigan Arts and Culture Council, connecting arts, culture, and our creative communities.
All right, let's find out what else made news in Michigan this week. Former Michigan House Speaker Lee Chatfield is facing more than a dozen felony charges. He's accused of misusing funds from the state, nonprofits, and political action committees. The state says he used the money for personal expenses, including paying off credit card debt and going on vacations. His lawyers say he is prepared to fight the charges. Nurses in Sault Ste. Marie went on strike this week, and by the time you hear this, the strike will have ended. The planned 5-day work stoppage was meant to call attention to 14 rounds of failed negotiations with My Michigan Health. The nurses want better wages and benefits, and U.S. Senator Gary Peters lent his support to their strike, saying the nurses' demands will help recruit and retain staff and ultimately result in better patient care. Senator Peters is also pressing Postmaster General Louis DeJoy to correct poor delivery service across the country. The U.S. Postal Service needs to identify how delivery changes are impacting customers, especially in rural areas like the Upper Peninsula. Overnight service is no longer available in the UP, impacting, among other things, water testing samples that need a 24-hour turnaround. And customers were not told the USPS had plans to move processing from Iron Mountain to Green Bay, Wisconsin. DeJoy says he would send the information on the impacts to Senator Peters by May 1st and, in the meantime, promised to delay future changes. The Cherry Bowl Drive-In Theater in Honor is up for sale, and realtors say many of the potential buyers want to keep it as a theater. Owner Laura Clark is retiring after managing the theater for more than 20 years, but she plans to oversee this summer's movie season from Memorial Day through Labor Day. The Cherry Bowl opened in 1953 and has room for about 275 vehicles. Another show will go on this summer, but in the sky, not on the screen. The National Cherry Festival and the Cherry Capital Airport have worked out their dispute over the festival's popular air show. At issue was the airport's growing flight schedule, which can be disrupted when the fighter jets are practicing and performing in the region's airspace. The two sides say they have found ways to make the show work for both the airline and the show performers and will continue to meet to streamline future shows. The air show is the highlight of the Cherry Festival, which brings in more than 500,000 visitors to Traverse City each year. And that's it for the Up North Lowdown this week. We had contributions from Izzy Ross, Ellie Katz, Tyler Thompson, Damwon Shura, Michael Livingston, and Max Howard. Music by Blue Dot Sessions and Svenborg Kardib. Our show is produced by me, Max Copeland, and edited by Ed Ronco. We make this podcast at Interlochen Public Radio. We'll leave you this week with a sound from just outside our front door here at IPR, a northern cardinal up in a tree chattering away on a spring evening. We can only assume she's saying, thanks for listening, but I'll add, have a great week.